Devices Radio Network.
Advices Radio is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The opinions of the host are not meant to be taken as medical advice. If you have a health concern, see a doctor immediately.
When it comes to the day of the contest, I'm his father. He comes to me for advices. So it's not that hard for me to give him the wrong advices. Advices.
Advices Radio. Advices Radio is presented by Knapps Gear. I'm your host, Scott McNally, and tonight I have a very special treat. I have the filmmaker, the documentarian, the legend himself, Mike Pulcinella. How you doing, Mike?
I'm good, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Man, thank you for being here. You know, I want to start this out by telling you how much of a fan I am and just how much this means to me.
Is this your story of the first time you saw Raising the Bar or something like that? Because I get this a lot. I get emails all the time. This is and I love this.
Well, good.
Give it to me.
You got to bear with me here then, because I do. This is that story. I was getting ready for my first contest prep, and I realized, you know, just how much work really goes into it, because it's something you don't realize until you've actually done it. And I was surfing through the internet. I was looking at different videos and stuff on YouTube, and I came across a trailer for Raising the Bar, and this is what I heard.
I know one thing for sure. The more unpleasant this is, and the more suffering I'm going through, the more likely I am going to win. It's just the way it works.
You have to be so single-mindedly disciplined to be a bodybuilder. It impacts your whole life, you know, revolves around your sport.
This is the part I hate.
I've never wanted anything more in my entire life. All I want to do is to lift and to grow.
No one wins a show of this caliber is comfortable the whole way through. It hurts, it's uncomfortable, it doesn't feel good. You gotta do things that are not right, not natural. The body will rebel from.
If someone's gonna beat me at this show, we're gonna have to combine two things. Better genetics than me, which is certainly a possibility. Having done more work than me, which is not.
A bodybuilder does not want to look normal. You want to walk into the room and everyone's head turns and says, oh my God, look at that human being.
I don't want to walk into a room and look like I work out, and I don't want to look fit and cute. I want people to be like, that chick's jacked.
And it was at that moment, man, I said to myself, okay, I got to buy this, and I got to buy this right now. And that's what I did. I probably watched that thing like 10, 15 times during the prep, maybe more. And I've been sold ever since, man. So thank you.
You're very welcome. Well, there's two things I want to say about that. One is, didn't Dave do such a great job putting that notion into words? Like, it's something I'm sure that everyone has thought about lots of different things, but especially about bodybuilding, but could never really put eloquently, could crystallize into words. And Dave had a knack for just saying things almost like as if it was scripted in such a way that it was just really memorable and sharp and funny and or powerful. So it always raised the hair on the back of my neck when I was shooting him, and he would do something like that and just come off with this really great quote off the top of his head. That's his talent, honestly. And the other thing is you say you watched it like 10 or more times?
Yes, I have to admit.
what about Raising the Bar made you able to watch it over and over and over again like that? Because that is what I hear from people, and it still astonishes me. I mean, I had to watch it that many times to edit it.
Sure.
But you don't have to. So, I mean, what was it about it that would reward repeated listening? That's what I don't understand.
That's a good question, man. You're putting me on the hot seat.
Because I wish I knew. If I knew exactly what it was, I could repeat that. But I don't. There's a certain magic to the Raising the Bars that even is beyond me a little bit.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you what. Especially when Raising the Bar first came out, there was nothing else in video, in bodybuilding movies that were like that.
That's true. You
touch upon that here, you know, in Raising the Bar 4, which has just come out. And that's really what we're here to talk about. But we can't talk about that without talking about everything else, you know.
And it
was kind of like it said everything I was feeling at the time. I remember, you know, like I met a girl. And I was in a relationship with her. She knew nothing about this experience. So you know what I did to explain it to her? I put Raising the Bar on it. I said, here, watch this.
I've heard that before, too. People say that all the time. And my girlfriend's not even a fan of bodybuilding, but she wanted to know what happened next. And do you know that is the biggest compliment you can give any filmmaker, writer, storyteller is, I wanted to know what happened next. That means I did my job.
Yeah, absolutely, man. So, you know, just looking back at that and then looking at the new Raising the Bar, which, you know, for everybody out there that doesn't know, Raising the Bar 4 is out now. Mike is releasing this in segments on YouTube. How can they get to it directly?
You can go to YouTube and search Mike Pulcinella or Raising the Bar 4. You go to my channel and all of the episodes that have been released are there. As of this recording, we have 7 episodes out. There's going to be a total of 11 that will just, you know, exist on YouTube forever.
Okay. So looking back at Raising the Bar 1, since we're talking about that now, and then looking forward to where you're at today, you know, what's changed in your process compared to all the way back then when you did Raising the Bar 1?
Actually, what I've tried to do is keep my process from changing as much as possible.
Hmm.
Like I entered into Raising the Bar 1 with the attitude of being the complete novice, outsider, I don't know anything about anything, please teach me. And that's what I told everyone. I told them a combination of, while I'm shooting, just ignore the camera. That's one aspect of this. When you're doing your thing, don't worry about me.
Okay.
Just do your thing. And then if I ask questions later, you're going to have to educate me because I don't know what I'm seeing. I tried to retain that sort of innocence.
I always
try to retain that innocence when I've worked with other athletes, with Kai Greene and Victor Martinez, and through this entire Raising the Bar saga, you know, I always try to not assume that I know what's what.
Yeah.
I walk into a situation and I say to myself, you don't know what's going on here. You got to figure it out. So it's an openness, a naivete that you try to retain. Now, obviously, I've been in the bodybuilding world now for years, and I kind of do know a lot about it.
Sure.
But I still try to put myself in that mindset of being the innocent outside observer. And that's a thing that I try to keep constant. The one thing that has changed, I think, is just my skill in putting these things together. You know, if you look at Raising the Bar 1, technically it's very crude. I had never shot before. I had never edited before. And it's rough. It's a rough homemade video, and that's fine. But it tells a coherent story. I discovered through Raising the Bar 1 that I was good at telling a story and keeping things moving.
Okay.
And that, I think, has developed over the course of the Raising the Bars and all the other videos I've done is I really know a lot more about, you know, the finer points of shooting and editing and filmmaking in general. But okay. I'm still trying to retain that innocent attitude.
That kind of brings me to my next question, actually, which, you know, looking at Raising the Bar 4, I would consider this to be a mature work of Mike Pulcinella. So what are the important tools that you've learned from your past experiences that you're bringing to Raising the Bar 4?
I think the word mature is the key there. I'm bringing much more life experience. It's my ability to put these stories together in a coherent way that I don't know necessarily I would have been able to when I started doing this in my early 40s. I'm 55 now. And I think it's just the maturity of being able to understand relationships and people and the dynamics of the industry itself that has changed. My methods pretty much remain the same.
Interesting. I didn't realize you're 55. You are a very young 55.
Thank you. I work on that. I try, you know, I exercise, I work out to try to maintain, you know, health and fitness for this job. because you have to be light on your feet and you're moving equipment and you're running around with a camera all day. That can be taxing. Plus, and then the other side of it is it's very sedentary. Then you're spending hours and hours and hours just sitting in a chair. That'll wreck your health quicker than anything else.
I could totally relate to that right now.
So I know you can. So, you know, my entire regimen, you know, diet and exercise is to, you know, combat that sedentary lifestyle and enhance, you know, going out on shoots.
Okay. But you know, a minute ago, you had talked about, you know, your relationship to your subjects. And I think it's interesting that as you've developed, you've talked more and more about how your relationship to your subject affects the final product and affects the way that the project turns out. Can you speak more on this? Because I know this is something you've thought a lot about.
Well, yeah, and it's one of the major themes of Raising the Bar 4 is how what I was doing affected the people that I was doing it with. And there have been good subjects and bad subjects. There have been projects that you'll never see that we've started and canceled just because the person couldn't be natural on camera, tried to direct the documentary too much. Here's a perfect example. And obviously this person will remain nameless, but the guy was a, he had a full-time job, but on the side, he liked to do Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And he would go to Brazil and fight in competitions every year, okay. Get himself in shape, and then go. And he wanted me to document that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he gave me this, you know, a down payment, and I hadn't heard from him in a while. And then he finally called up. He goes, oh, I'm sorry. I was out of touch for a while, but you know, my father died, and then I had to have some surgery. And I was looking at myself in the mirror, and I looked like shit, and I was bursting into tears, and I couldn't stand it. And I said, why didn't you call me? Oh, no, no, you don't want to show that. He said, let me get in shape a little bit, and then we'll start shooting. And I said, you don't understand my methods, first of all, if you think that I want to start halfway through your preparation.
Right.
No. I said, we've got to experience your lows so we can appreciate the highs when you hopefully win this thing or whatever. And the fact that you're going through this shit and keeping me out of it shows that psychologically you don't understand how this works and you're not prepared to really let it all hang out on film.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think that some of that is – I mean, I know some of it's trust. Do you think some of it's pride too?
Oh, it's pride and ego. Absolutely. Absolutely. You bump up against ego all the time in this thing. And I gotta say – I wouldn't want to be on the other side of the lens.
Sure, sure.
I mean,
no, I understand. Literally, we're not making judgments here.
But literally, I mean, literally, you have to agree that when you look the worst, feel the worst, the last thing you want in your face is a camera, then I'm going to be there.
Yeah.
You have to agree to that, or else we can't really experience the entire journey.
Yeah. So, you know, when you started out, you've pointed out, like, just how lucky you were to have Dave. And then you moved on and everything kind of blew up for you. Before you know it, you are filming Kai Greene. Right. and as you've expressed, you know, and I've heard this story, you know, a couple times that you've mentioned now. It shows up here in Raising the Bar 4, and I've seen you talking about it elsewhere. How did that feel when you basically, I mean, from what I understand, the way I see it, it looks like you kind of hit a brick wall, you know, with Kai, and they shut you out. And how did that make you feel? And then also, if you were to approach that situation again, because I feel like it probably caught you off guard to an extent, how would you approach that differently now?
Well, I don't really think I was, that they were shutting me out so much as that the way I worked was so different from what they were used to.
Okay.
I mean, you know, in the past when a website like Muscular Development or whoever would send a videographer around, it was a very surfacey kind of thing. They'd do an interview here, a little bit of training footage there, and they were gone. I wanted to embed myself with them. I wanted to be in the hotel room when they're having protein farts and fighting and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's what they were... They couldn't understand that that's what I wanted to film. And so I think it was the fact that it was a different paradigm for them. Hmm. They literally didn't understand. I mean, even though Oscar and Kai had both seen Raising the Bar, you know, when it's your turn in the spotlight, it's not quite what you think it is. And it's a lot more difficult. And I just think they were completely unused to my methods. And at the same time, they were focused on a different goal.
Okay.
This goal, you know, what I had to do was not as important to them as winning their first Olympia. So that was certainly, you know, foremost on their mind.
Sure, sure. So what kind of person does make for a good documentary?
You know, I've asked that myself a lot. You know, I was spoiled at first. You know, I thought that Dave was average. I thought that my brother was normal and that I would encounter that kind of openness and eloquence everywhere. And it just simply wasn't the case. You've got to be, I think, somewhat of an exhibitionist, really. You've got to be able to tune me out for at times and just live naturally. And you know how hard that is when someone's got a camera for you to forget that it's there. It takes a long time. And sometimes it's a matter of spending a lot of time with people. But you've also got to be eloquent. You've got to be able to take your thoughts and put them into words in a way that is memorable and sharp and interesting. And that's probably the rarest thing of all, is that people just don't really speak that well. And most of the time when you do interviews, you run up against the fact that they don't have the vocabulary or the ability to just put things together in a way that's entertaining and interesting.
Hmm.
Dave could certainly do that. And Haley could certainly do that. She always could do that. I lucked out with her too. But I have found that finding someone like that it's kind of rare.
Hmm.
At least in my experience. Now Kai is like that too. He can't really speak eloquently on topics. You know, I don't think I would be surprising anyone to tell you that he's very wordy, that he speaks a lot,
sure.
And that it takes a lot of editing to sharpen him up. But he does give you the material. It just takes his mental process is just different. It's more circuitous than most people, and it takes a while to get around to his point. And that's why I think Kai needs a good editor more than most.
Hmm. I've heard you say that before. I remember when he was doing those, like, the cardio confessional type videos and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and they would be like a half hour long. I really had a hard time focusing on it, you know, for that whole period of time. It was just so much. But yeah, when you've edited it down and you pull the information and put it together in a way that I can digest, I mean, I find it to be some really moving stuff for sure.
I think Kai and I did have a good rapport. In other words, I knew what he was getting at. I knew what he was trying to say. And sometimes he confused a lot of people. I knew where he was going with this stuff. And because of that, I found that I could chop up his speeches a little bit better and, you know, add my own material to really clarify what he's saying.
Hmm.
That was, I think, our strength together.
Interesting. I'm kind of putting you on the spot here. You probably won't have a good answer for me, but I'm going to try anyway.
Go ahead.
Do you have any interesting Kai trivia that, like, because you basically did. You were the fly on the wall. Something that, like, none of us would have guessed that, obviously, that he wouldn't mind you sharing, too, of course.
Obviously. Well, I kind of addressed that, I think, in Raising the Bar 4. And I think the thing that people don't realize about Kai is he is as vulnerable and insecure as anyone.
Hmm.
I mean, he's the number two bodybuilder in the world. Some would say the number one. But, you know, he has the same kind of doubts and failings as the rest of us. Some of that comes out in Raising the Bar 4. You can see that, you know, where when put under the spotlight of my camera, he kind of – I don't want to say fell apart, but it wasn't as together as he wanted to be. So I think that was probably the biggest revelation to me, that this guy who was so physically massive was just as sensitive and delicate as the rest of us.
The painful, embarrassing realities that comes along with a camera there, and the painful realities are that the camera doesn't blink. And the camera doesn't try to give you anything. The camera just quietly observed. It never changes its expression. It never tells you, hey, you're doing something good, or hey, give me more of that. Camera doesn't do that. Hey, you know what, Kai? That's your good side. Camera doesn't do that. Camera when you see the material, you see all the things that bring to you shame and disappointment. The camera will highlight the scar on the side of your face. It'll highlight the other scar on the other side of your face. It'll highlight, yo, there's another scar on the back of his head. The pain that you otherwise believe that you have somewhat, you know, come to terms with and are able to hide.
So kind of, you know, looking at everything you've done now and, you know, seeing that, you know, you've gotten to you know, started out with Raising the Bar and you moved on from there. You've worked with names like Victor Martinez and Kai Green and so many more. You know, before all this, you were working at the Family Printing Company, correct?
That is correct.
So would you have ever imagined yourself in the middle of the bodybuilding industry like this today?
This is the most surprising development in my life. I could never have predicted it. You know, a lot of people who are successes in various areas say that people ask them, well, how did you do it? Because I want to do what you do. And almost everyone says the same thing. The path that I took to get here was so improbable and so circuitous that I can't recommend it to you. And it's the same with me. The things that happened were a combination of luck and fortune and lots of hard work to get here. But no one could repeat that because a lot of it also had to do with timing. It's like you said earlier, where there was nothing like this at the time.
Yeah.
You know, I was lucky enough to be putting up clips of Raising the Bar in kind of like the early days of YouTube, when there wasn't as much of a flood of content as there is now.
Interesting.
Especially not bodybuilding content. I don't know if releasing Raising the Bar now, it would have the same impact, because there's a lot of this kind of thing out there. You know, there's a lot of good filmmakers making stuff in the bodybuilding world. James Grealish is one of them.
Absolutely. And
I mentioned him in the documentary. He's someone who I think is really going to take this to the next level, because he's also a trained filmmaker, which I was not. And you can see it in his work.
Absolutely.
But I was literally the big fish in the non-existent pond at that time. There was nothing like this. And I have to emphasize, again, I say this in Raising the Bar 4, I have to emphasize that it wasn't a calculated thing. It wasn't like, you know, no one's doing this kind of thing in bodybuilding. I was just doing what I wanted to do.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's always my advice to people, is just follow your passion, be really passionate about it, work really hard at it, and then keep your eyes open for opportunities.
Interesting, yeah.
Because there's an old saying, you know, that luck is when opportunity meets preparation.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And I certainly had prepared enough. And then when MHP called me and said, do you want a job working with some of the top bodybuilders in the world? I was ready for it.
Yeah.
More or less. Not completely, honestly. There's a lot of technical mistakes that I continued to make throughout the early years. But basically, yeah, I had prepared for it with no idea that it would pay off.
We never saw those mistakes. So as far as I'm concerned, you didn't.
Because I'm a good editor. You'll never see the mistakes.
So, you know, talking about this stuff, you found a formula that worked. You found something that was successful. And I think that making a successful piece of art can be a blessing and a curse for an artist. You know, you find that formula, you got something. If you were like an inventor, you would just now set up a production line and start churning out the same thing and make copies of it. Obviously, the task is much more difficult for an artist. So in Raising the Bar 4, you've already found your voice. You found the successful formula. Going into this project, what are you doing consciously to make sure that you're continuing to be honest and speak from your heart and to make something that is new and not just replicating the old movies?
I that's a good question, because it took me a long time to do Raising the Bar 4 because of that very thing.
Okay.
I didn't want to just repeat myself. And it's very easy to repeat yourself in the bodybuilding world, because bodybuilding, you know, the lifestyle is a lot about repetition. It's about repeating the same actions over and over again. And we had kind of showed that. And a lot of people showed that, you know, the meals and the training and the preparation for the show. I mean, once we had kind of laid that all out and I showed it to the best of my ability, I didn't want to keep showing that again. You know, more about the food, more about, there wasn't really that much interest there for me or I thought for the general public.
Sure.
What I needed to do was to take this perfected formula, as you say, you know, the way I do things,
right.
The way, the voiceover and everything, where I put things together and combine it in a way that I hadn't done before. If I couldn't find a way to take the footage that I had been shooting these past few years and put it together in a way that I hadn't quite done before, I wasn't going to do it. And I started and stopped many times over the past, five or so years. And I would hit a wall and I would just give up. I can't do this. It's just too mundane. It's the same thing as I did before. I don't like it. And basically that's my judgment is that if I'm not interested, if I don't like watching it, because I have to watch it over and over again to get it right.
Sure.
If I'm not enjoying watching it, then no one else will.
Hmm.
And so I challenged myself to find a way to put this together, to take it to the next level and put it together in a way that challenged me, that used the formula, but in a different way. And I think by intertwining all these different stories, some of them outside of the world of bodybuilding, that I've actually achieved that.
Interesting. So one question in particular about decisions that you've made. There's no talk about any type of performance-enhancing drugs through any of your films. And
right.
when I first started watching Raising the Bar, I had wondered, okay, is this going to be a topic he covered? And then from there, you know, it wasn't, and I just accepted, okay, that's not going to be part of this world. So I take it that was a decision that you made early on in making films. What's your reasoning behind that?
Well, that was kind of a decision that was made for me early on. Mm. No one would talk about it. I mean, I was going to put it into the first Raising the Bar. I mean, I know it's a big part of bodybuilding. I have no problem with it one way or the other. I consider steroid use a calculated risk, like so many risks that human beings take to push the envelope, to fly higher, to go faster, to punch harder. There are risks involved, and I consider that just like any other risk that an athlete takes. But I tried to put it into Raising the Bar 1, and no one would talk to me about it.
Interesting.
Because it's illegal.
Yeah.
There were times where the conversation would come up between bodybuilders. They needed to talk about their protocol, and they'd say, "Can you turn that off, please?"
Yeah.
And I'd have to, or else I would be kicked out of the room. So I decided this is too sensitive a topic. And to be honest, that's not even really why I'm here.
Yeah.
Because I started to realize in the first Raising the Bar that what I was there to show was the passion and how sometimes too much passion can affect your life and your relationships when you become too devoted to something. That's kind of been like the theme throughout, you know, how much is too much and how much can your family and friends and significant others take from. And so that's always been my focus. And I kind of just set the steroids to the side. Today, it's certainly a lot more open. Like my brother himself, he's had threads on forums where he's talked about given advice to people about dosages and all that kind of stuff and how you stay healthy during the off season and all that kind of stuff. So even he's very open about it, but I became uninterested in it, to be honest with you.
Hmm.
And again, going back to James Grealish, he's really tackling that right now.
Absolutely.
With his Under Construction series. So I feel like, okay, he's taking care of that and taking care of it in a great way. I don't need to do it. Let me talk about what's interesting to me, which is interpersonal relationships.
Yeah, that makes sense, man. And that's – I see that and I see where that's the focus. And I feel like it's such a controversial topic that if you were to bring that in, it might take the light away from what you're trying to do.
Yeah, and I think I've said this before probably too many times, is that I'm not a super huge fan of bodybuilding per se.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating because it's an extreme activity that you have to devote so much more of your time to than just about any other similar activity. Like weightlifters, like my cousin Steve is a powerlifter. I mean, he can powerlift intensely for a couple of hours a day and then just relax the rest of the day and eat whatever he wants, and he doesn't have to worry about too much else. But a bodybuilder is never off. You're always on. And that sort of fascinated me about it. But not being like a super big fan of the sport itself.
Sure.
Those details weren't that interesting to me. I really could have been making this about anything that people were passionate about and devoted themselves that intensely to.
Something that's so extreme. I could see
it. It could have been anything. But this was the thing that just happened to be in my lap because my brother was doing it since he was a teenager.
You just mentioned relationships a couple of times. You know, mm-hmm. I've heard Dave say before that a lot of people really like Raising the Bar too. And I think he had said that that was his least favorite one.
And that's my most favorite one.
It's mine too. That was great. And I have to say that I can't quite put 4 in here yet because I haven't seen the end yet.
Right.
And I'll need to digest a little bit more. But yeah, absolutely. Raising the Bar 2 was very strong. And it was very emotionally driven. There was a lot of relationship stuff going on in there. And it was stuff that I felt like I could relate to. I feel like you are definitely revisiting a lot of intense relationship stuff with this Raising the Bar 4. And I feel like you've even taken it to a deeper level.
We're not together. We have parted ways. We're not together anymore. So I've been dating around and trying to forget and trying to block that out because it was pretty traumatic for me. I didn't want that to go down that way. I wanted to stay with her, but I really couldn't.
Was the age a factor? The age difference a factor?
I would love to say no, but ultimately what ended up happening, I believe, was a product of her age and inexperience with relationships. So, yes.
Can you tell me a little bit more? I'd just love to hear you talk a little bit more about what you think about that aspect of Raising the Bar 4.
That was the biggest aspect of at least the first few episodes of Raising the Bar 4 to me, is what happened between Dave and Haley.
Oh, it was heart-wrenching.
It was heart-wrenching. And, you know, and I'm witnessing it firsthand and getting footage of it. It was so intense that I thought that it really needed to be told. And again, I have to thank both of them for being as open as they are about what is really kind of a painful, sensitive topic for them. Both of them watching the release of these videos has dredged up a lot of emotions. Neither one of them are handling it very well, to be honest with you.
I could imagine. I mean, it
wasn't
even me.
They're fine with me putting it out there, but they're having problems personally redealing with all of this stuff again. I think that eventually, especially for Haley, that she's coming out already on the other side of this much stronger than she was before by seeing things that were just in her head from an objective point of view, from my point of view. She's seeing things in a different way, and I think she's reanalyzing what happened to her during that time, and it's making her stronger and healthier.
Interesting. Yeah, I could tell you. Yeah, it wasn't even me dealing with these situations on the film I'm watching, and I was kind of like doubling over a little bit because I feel like everybody can relate to probably being in both sides of that position.
Yeah, well, I did an initial cut of Raising the Bar 4 where we didn't talk about the actual reason why they split up.
Okay,
because it's very sensitive, I did some test screenings, so what I call a focus group. I had about a dozen people watch it, and everyone said the same thing. Oh, this is great, but you got to tell us why they broke up.
Okay.
Like, because we can't accept that they're going their separate ways and tears are streaming down her face without knowing why it happened. And so I had to go back, and this happened recently. I had to go back and say to the two of them, can we talk about what really happened?
Really?
Which they really had only glanced upon publicly in a podcast with Matt Meinrod a couple of years ago.
I remember that, yeah.
And there's actually some clips of that. I used the audio from that in Raising the Bar 4 and then expanded on a little bit. But that was a very sensitive topic for them. And they both sort of like rolled their eyes like, oh, do we have to? And I'm like, yes, you have to, or else the whole project is, I think, is going to fail. Because people are just going to be too frustrated not knowing why you broke up. Because we showed everything with Dave and Jen in the early Raising Bar 1 and 2, we showed why they were being pulled apart at the seams.
Sure, sure.
You saw that whole progression. And then to not see it here, it kind of felt like a cheat.
I could see that for sure. So I also noticed that, like, speaking of the relationship issues and stuff, there are different periods that come up on the YouTube video where it says, to hear the whole story, click here.
Yes.
So this has got layers to it. That's something you really – I mean, I suppose with a DVD, you could put special features on and you could say, you know, have that as a special feature after the DVD. But what was your choice to do it this way and then have these other things, like go here to click on this video to watch the Victor Martinez program that you did? Well, why release it on YouTube instead of put it on DVD like the other three and make some money that way?
There are several reasons why I did that. One is my YouTube channel is monetized. So those ads that come up, I mean, I am making money off of this. It's not completely free. I'm making money off of all the videos on my channel. Not a lot, but something. I get a little pump into my PayPal every month from YouTube.
Nice.
Because of people watching the videos. Yeah, it's nice.
I will watch them all again for you then.
And thank you. That'll probably add up to like 3.5 cents. But yes. Still, you really need millions of views to make big money. But that's okay. I'm trying to build my subscribers. I want people to come to the channel to discover what else is there. And I have a few things up my sleeve that I'm going to be releasing, you know, after Raising the Bar, that should be interesting to anyone who subscribes to the YouTube channel because of Raising the Bar.
Okay.
So that was the one thing. You know, I like the fact that that I'm getting what's called, you know, passive income YouTube, you know, and I wanted to build that up. Another thing is that I heard way too much from people about the DVDs, they were trying to pirate them, and they wanted to know where the torrents was. I mean, I've had conversations with people about this for years, and I've, you know, said, you know, torrenting, pirating, I mean, that's basically stealing.
Sure.
You walk into a Target and shove a DVD down your pants. If you wouldn't do that, then you shouldn't download a movie. Certainly not a movie of your quote-unquote favorite bodybuilder,
like
or something,
goes
through all the expense and trouble of making a DVD for you, and then you're just going to steal it from them? How do you justify that? So I've had these conversations with people, and I kind of almost wanted to say, to put it out there almost as a fuck you to people who are trying to steal the Raising the Bars. Like, here, this one's free. Just watch it. And meanwhile, I can make a few cents off of it, you know. Anyway, but there was another factor involved in that it's so different from the first three Raising the Bars. It's really not like them at all. The first three Raising the Bars were very concise in that they had a beginning, middle, and end, because each one was about getting to a particular contest.
Right.
And that makes for a very easy narrative arc of story. You know, the beginning, the hard middle, and then either you succeed or fail at the end. This was completely different. There was no contest. David did not come out of retirement. We'll get to that in a little bit.
All right.
There was no single goal. And so it felt, as at least while I was putting it together, very sort of diffuse and like I was pulling in and trying to weave together a lot of different things, which I was. Also, a lot of it is not specifically about bodybuilding. A lot of it brings in aspects from my own life outside of the bodybuilding world, but that are relevant to the story in the long run.
Sure.
And I thought that people purchasing a DVD of that might feel a little cheated.
Yeah.
But I'm calling it Raising the Bar, and it's really something different.
Interesting.
I kind of wanted the luxury of being able to say, hey, here it is. Like it or hate it, you didn't have to pay for it.
Interesting, huh?
Because then it can exist on its own. And I've had a few people, I've had some comments on some of the forums like, what the fuck is this thing about some religious priest guy cutting the throats of what the hell that went in here? And I understand, but that's not what you expect to see in a bodybuilding video.
Yeah.
But it's in there for a reason, and it leads up to something else. I didn't want people saying, hey, I spent, you know, $25-$35 on this DVD, and it's not about bodybuilding at all.
I see.
It's nothing about, you know, how much I should eat or how many sets and reps I should do.
Or which six foods work.
Which six foods, because it's not about the details of the bodybuilding lifestyle. It's about bodybuilding as a whole and how everything sort of filters through that. And that's kind of like a delicate kind of road to travel. And I, to be honest with you, I was really, really unsure about this thing. I didn't know if people would like it at all.
Interesting. You gave yourself the freedom to do what you wanted to do without facing the judgment that could come along with charging somebody $30 for it. I get it. That's interesting.
Raising the bar for is exactly what I want it to be.
Interesting.
And if people don't like it, that's absolutely fine with me. I don't have to refund their money.
I'm going to need to go back through after all of them are released and watch it all together, because I'm at a point right now where there are so many different pieces. I've heard Dave say it. I've heard you say it, that it all comes together.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm waiting for right now.
You know, the decision, I wanted to originally release it like Netflix does, where they do an entire season's worth, 12 or 14 episodes, like with Orange is the New Black.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And then just release it all at once. So you could watch it. You could binge it if you wanted to or not. But I have a YouTube consultant that I've been working with on growing my YouTube channel.
Interesting.
And he said the best way is to tease it out over a period of time. Eventually, all the episodes will exist in one unit and people can binge it if they want, but that you get more attention by squeezing it out over however many weeks, as long as you do it on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Because you lose people if you don't have a regular release date.
That's the same with podcasting.
Right? Yeah. It's the same. Yep. So I had to finish the thing and then start to release it. So I made sure that I had them all in my back pocket, as it were.
Okay.
And be able to release them on a regular basis. Yes, it's a little frustrating to have to wait a week to see like the next 15 or 20 minutes, but eventually it will all exist as one big playlist.
Yeah, yeah.
And I tried, I didn't want to put in like a big intro on each one of the episodes. If you notice, it just starts.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't go in for like the big fancy animated intros with explosions and flames and all the music and shit, especially for something like this, because I'm anticipating people watching all 11 episodes in a row, and I want one to end and the next one to begin, and you don't have to sit through the same, you know, Raising the Bar theme song 11 times.
Have you noticed that if you watch Netflix now, they will, and you consecutively watch episodes, they cut that out. Like it'll automatically start right after the intro of the show.
I love that. I love that.
That is pretty cool. So there are so many parts. I don't want to go into like every single one of them. I'll tell you today, and I got to tell the listening audience, I guess that being the host of Advices Radio has its perks. I was allowed to watch a couple of advanced copies here that you guys haven't seen yet. So we are going to see Ian McCarthy a little bit later.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be honest with you. I was so irritated by him, like just so irritated. And I want to ask you, like, how do you feel? Cause I know like, okay, the filmmaker is the objective, you know, just I that's just there watching, but you know, you can't help but be a human being and have your own emotion and feelings. How did you feel about dealing with him?
Don't let any filmmaker, don't let any documentary filmmaker tell you that he's objective. There's no such thing. There is always an agenda. There is always a viewpoint, even if you try not to.
Yeah.
You know what? It's a love-hate relationship with that kid, because he is really smart. And I do really admire his principles. Like, he's got some strong principles and he's really intelligent. But he's also very abrasive, and there are. I find that I've known some super intelligent people who are like that.
That's a good point. Yeah,
they're a little too smart for their own good, and they disdain everyone around them because no one can keep up with them. And that's it's the truth. I mean, I've known like super genius kind of people, who you just can't keep up with, and they dismiss everyone. Everyone's too stupid.
And they have a lack of ability to relate to people on a and be social. Yeah, I understand what you mean.
Plus, he's a kid.
Yes, he is.
He's a kid with immense power, you know, the social media power. He started to do this thing. Again, he was just doing what he wanted to do because he saw people saying what he thought were ridiculous things about how the fitness industry. So he started making some videos. All of a sudden, he gets this massive, vitriolic following who will do anything he says. How could that not go to your head?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
But I believed in the premise that if I could get him there in front of me and talk to him long enough that the human side will come out, that we'll find what's really going on behind what really motivates his actions.
Yeah.
And I think we did. I think I don't know. I feel like I humanized him quite a bit.
Absolutely.
I mean, he's still kind of an arrogant, abrasive guy. Not so much now. I think he's mellowed a bit. And part of that was the process of working with me. Hmm. I have to take a little responsibility for that.
I think it shows, too. I think that shows in the video that I can see where, like, some change came in. And I thought that was really interesting. And it's not that I totally disagree with what he's saying. I just felt like I didn't like his delivery. And I felt like he was telling me that I was a stereotype. He was saying that, like, we're all gonna, like, I never yell at, but I never think less of somebody for eating pizza, you know? But he's saying that, like, all bodybuilders, like, this is, you know, so, but he's just as much of a stereotype, too, at the other end, you know?
You see him say something like that.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, for those that don't know what we're talking about, you know, Ian McCarthy and my brother had a sort of an online battle.
I should have set that up. Yes.
Yeah, my brother being the old school, you know, kind of bodybuilding diet guru where you have to sort of suffer and just eat real clean foods. And Ian sort of representing this sort of new school IFYM where it's not, you don't have to be quite so strict and you can still reach the goals that you're trying to reach. And they were butting heads online. And I knew that if I could get them to sit down at the table across from each other, that it wouldn't be like it was online. I knew that, and I wanted to see that happen, and of course it did. Immediately,
they are surprised by how much in agreement they are on this topic.
Absolutely. What is your thing with meal frequency?
Well, my thing is that many people in this industry, most people, in fact, in this industry, fitness models and self-declared gurus, believe that it's necessary that people eat every 2 to 3 hours, or they'll say 5 to 6 meals a day, or you'll hear people say things like, you know, I eat 10 meals a day to stoke the metabolic furnace. Right. This is a hugely overused cliche.
Right.
The problem is that they're just not correct, because we're talking about two things here. We're talking about basal metabolic rate, and we're talking about the thermic effect of food,
right,
neither of which is affected by how often you eat. Those are dictated by how much you eat. And if you agree with that, well, then we're on exactly the same starting point.
I agree with you to a great degree. It's not necessary.
Yeah.
And that the necessity of it, I think, depends upon what you're trying to do.
But here's the problem between what he was saying, what my brother was saying, and I could see it from the outside, and I kind of wanted them to come to it naturally, was that the goals were different. Mm. What Ian was talking about for his followers was kind of like a beach body kind.
Yes, yes.
A muscular and pretty lean kind of – you didn't have to go to extremes to do that.
Sure, and Dave would agree with that.
And Dave agreed with that. But in order to be, you know, 250 pounds of almost all muscle.
Yeah, 2% body fat.
Right, 2% body fat was such an extreme area that had never been explored, not really, by any scientific study, that for them to for the Ian crowd to sort of lump in upper level bodybuilders with themselves was kind of an arrogant move.
Yes.
It didn't make much sense. And I wanted to see if Dave could convince in of that face-to-face. Hmm. Because I certainly, and I show this in Raising the Bar 4, I certainly dig into the scientific studies themselves, and I think I show some flaws in their reasoning.
Absolutely.
In their reasoning, not entirely, but in their reasoning of applying it to upper-level bodybuilding. And that's always the issue, is that they're trying to apply something for like a general populace.
Right.
High-level bodybuilding. And high-level bodybuilding is a different category. They can't accept that. Hmm. And I wanted to see if we could bring these two guys together. Not completely, but to a certain extent, I think we did. And it's up to the viewer to decide how much.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, I got a big question for you here. And I don't even know if this is a question you even thought about yet. But the question that exists for every artist, what's next?
What is next? That's funny because you've seen episodes 1 through 10, but you haven't seen episode 11. And oh. it literally, because I'm still putting it together, honestly. I'm a little behind schedule.
Okay.
It literally asks that question. In fact, those are the last words of episode 11 are,
wow,
what's next? One of the things I always wanted to do was take the skills that I've honed and use them, you know, apply them to good causes and try to help people with good causes, you know, reach a wider audience. I was working with a boxer, a Bolivian boxer, the name of Jennifer Salinas for MHP.
Okay.
And, you know, we were doing all the normal MHP kind of stuff, you know, talking about the products. And she was really great on camera. And she's got some kids. And we were doing some training, some boxing training. And, you know, she's attractive and she's a vicious fighter. And so it was really good footage. And then, you know, I was doing the interview with her and I started to uncover that she's got some deep trauma in her past that fueled her fighting, which was childhood sexual abuse.
Okay.
So we started to talk about that on camera.
Wow.
And then she mentioned that she helps a foundation in Bolivia that takes in children who have been, you know, sexually or otherwise abused. And she's sort of like a spokesperson for that foundation. And I'm like, Jennifer, why don't we put something together where we talk about your past a little bit and we can talk about this place and maybe we can, you know, because she has a lot of fans and they don't know this side of her. And so we did a little video, which we put out there. And that's the kind of thing that makes me feel good. You know, she teared up in the middle of it. I mean, it was a very emotional moment for her. Again, I made sure that she got to see it in its entirety before we put it out there so that she was comfortable with everything that, you know,
right,
had said. Because most people are not comfortable crying on camera. And I, you know, basically I led her to a place through the interview where she was getting emotional. And it was a little embarrassing for her in the moment. But when she saw what I did with it in the video, she was fine with it. But it's things like that that I hope to be able to do to use the skills to reach people and maybe do some good.
Wow, that's really intense.
Yeah.
So why don't you let us know, Mike, you know, where can everybody find you? I mean, of course, we got to see Raising the Bar, but anything else you have going on, I want to know about all of it. Where can we go?
You know, just like everyone else, the best place is Facebook.
Okay.
I've got a personal page, a Mike Pulcinella page. I've also got a Mike Pulcinella Video Productions fan page, and I post things on there all the time. You can PM me. You can message me through those. You can give me your email address. I add it to my private notification list. I never give those emails to anyone else.
Okay.
And I will send out email blasts every once in a while, you know, giving some of the links of things that I've worked on. Of course, you can subscribe to my YouTube page, which you can easily get to through my Facebook page right now because, you know, everything's about Raising the Bar 4, and I always put in a link to the YouTube page. And if you subscribe there, as soon as I upload a video, you'll get an email notification.
Nice.
So all of those ways are the best ways to keep track of what's going on.
Okay. And then do you have a site that people can go to buy the older Raising the Bar films?
I do, MikePulcinella.com. And you can get either the DVDs. I got to say, I only have a few copies of the DVDs left of Raising the Bar. I don't know if I'm going to make any more.
Really?
Of the physical DVDs. Yeah, I'm not sure. I've only got maybe 5 or 6. But I've also have all three, Raising the Bar 1, 2, and 3, on the website as downloads.
Interesting. Nice.
In 3 different formats, like you know, low res, medium res, and high res for your phone, tablet, or computer.
Oh, cool.
You know, for a greatly reduced price, way less than the DVDs cost, obviously, because there's no material charges.
I might have to do that. My my now wife, we were both dieting, and she wasn't paying attention. she left the second disc for part three on the floor. I'm calling you out here, April. She's going to listen to this. And of course, we're both dieting. We're walking through the messy living room, and I hear a crunch under my foot.
Oh, no. So wait a minute. Part three, Raise the Bar 3, disc 2?
Yes.
I've got some extras. Let me send you a replacement.
Oh, no.
Let me send you a replacement for that. Come on.
All right.
At least I can do it.
I will take it. I will take it, and I will be happy.
Yeah, give me your address.
I scored here.
Yes, you did.
All right, April, I won't be mad at you anymore. All right, Mike. Well, listen, man, you know, I can't tell you enough just how much I appreciate the work you've done and how much it has meant to me, not only to me, but to a lot of my friends and obviously to the bodybuilding community. You've honestly, you've changed the face of bodybuilding documentary, and I appreciate everything you've got here, and I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thanks. I hope people, you know, can get into and really enjoy this series. It is a little bit different. You know, kind of prepare yourself for that. There's a lot of different stories that I will try to intertwine. Hopefully it's interesting all the way through, and that's really all I'm hoping for.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Thanks for hanging out and listening to this interview with Mike Polsonella. Up next, Chuck Zarowski and I answer listener questions from the question box at advicesradio.com and the Advices Radio Facebook page. Then from there, we go into a discussion about diuretics, the type of diuretics that exist in medicine, which ones to use in bodybuilding and which ones to stay away from. Guys, stay tuned. Welcome back to Advices Radio, episode 11. Thanks for coming back, guys. We're going to do a little bit of Q&A here. I'm back with Chuck Zarowski, and we're going to do a couple of questions, and then after that, I wanted to pick his brain on diuretics. How you doing, Chuck?
Good. How you doing, Scott? Everything well?
Yeah, everything's going really good, man.
Good.
We've got this this new format to the show, which hopefully everybody's enjoying. I'm sure we'll get some feedback in the next couple of weeks. But yeah, man, I'm excited about it. So how have you been? How's training going?
Training's going good. I'm training at another gym now. It's a powerlifting strongman gym called the Strength Depot.
Okay.
It's kind of nice because they have, like, you know, implementations that I'm not used to. Like, they have the Conan's wheel, they have a lot of sandbags, they have farmer walks up to, like, I think 125 pounds unloaded.
Nice.
They have, like, the Atlas stones, like I said. It's just, it's a cool little place. Monolift is there. It's just some place where it's a key. I love training at Detroit Barbell, but the distance is pretty far, and this is like 10 minutes away from my house, so I have a key. My hours are kind of odd at work now because I changed jobs.
Yeah.
So, and my hours are going to be, I'm going to be working like an afternoon shift, so but this is going to be nice because I have a key and I can just get in. It's 10 minutes from the house, and, you know, man, they let my son go there too, so like my son's 10. And I can take him there, and, you know, he can play on their Wi-Fi or whatever. And I must say, he did his first bench press yesterday.
Nice.
I just put the bar on, and he did 45 pounds.
Hell yeah, good for him.
Yeah, I did the 30-pound – they have a 35-pound bar, and I let him do that.
Okay.
But today he was complaining – yesterday he was complaining about, like, my shoulders are sore a little bit, Dad.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yep, that's good. That's what we want. So we did that, and then I had him pick up a kettlebell properly for the first time.
Cool.
Just to And so just a brief introduction, let him play his video games, brief introduction, and then it's been cool. So thank you, Shane, for letting my son come in.
That's badass, man. So you're saying you've got a key. This is like legitimate old school. You put a key in the door and you're in this gym 24 hours a day. Any time of the day you could go there, huh?
Absolutely. It's a warehouse, so it's kind of like it's like in an industrial complex. So
okay.
You have the same key opens up the back door to the front door. So it's kind of nice because like you go in, you put on your music, and then if nobody's got their music on, you just put your own music on, plug it in your iPad or your iPod.
Yeah.
And then – like, let's say you want to do the prowler push, or have you ever pushed a prowler, Scott?
I never have, no, but I'd love to.
Scott, come on over, man. Like,
hell yeah, I got to do this.
Have you ever heard of the prowler flu?
No, no.
Prowler flu is when you throw up. So this thing, I don't know how much the sled weighs, but you add weight to it. And the way your body gets into like to the position, it's all like you have to get low or you can't push the damn thing. So it's like it puts you in like a perfect athletic position. And then you're sprinting with it or you're pushing heavy weights with it. And you're pushing it down and then you're pushing it back. You do it for, you know, a set amount or whatever. You open the bay doors. There's this big bay door and then there's this parking lot. So it's perfect to push the prowler.
Nice.
And essentially, you just get sick. It's all that it's all the lactate building up, and it's all the hydrogen building up, and your body just wants to get rid of it now.
Wow, and so, man, that's amazing.
Yeah, but it's the best conditioning tool that I've ever seen in my life. There's nothing better.
Holy crap! So what? I mean, besides conditioning, besides central nervous system stimulation, like what? Mm-hmm. What muscles are? I mean, I'm sure it's a large chain of muscles. But what is it? What is working in this movement?
You can do it a couple different ways, but a lot of it's your essential posterior chain. So your hamstrings, your glutes, your lower back, the way that it's actually your abdominals, the way that basically you're bracing from your arms. Because you're pushing with your arms,
okay,
all the way down to your feet. So your whole body is getting worked on it, essentially. But what you're doing is, you know, like when think of a sprinter. A sprinter trains anaerobically,
right?
So you know, a sprinter is training in, you know, 100 meters. Like you watch the Olympics, those guys are fast and explosive. They're not slowing down. Essentially, it works the same type of thing. It's a loaded sprint, essentially. And so you're getting your hamstrings, your glutes, your lower back, and you're hitting it in such a way where it's sports specific because you're pushing it low, and then you're essentially like, you know, your conditioning is bar none, because by the time you're gasping for air, you need oxygen.
Right.
Most of the time when you get done with it, you're laying on your back.
No kidding.
And the thing is like you can actually pull it too. So like let's say you put some handles on it.
Okay.
Not some handles, but you can take a rope and you can pull it backwards. So when you're pulling it backwards, you're getting direct quad work.
Wow.
You can push. I mean, you can do a million different things with it, but it's the best conditioning tool on the planet. And the muscles that you work, like you can actually, instead of like just being conditioning, load that thing up with as heavy weight as you can go and push it. You can push it very, very slowly. And that's the thing. It's good for rehab too, because it's eccentric-less. So you're getting just strictly the concentric, the positive of it.
Right.
And you're not getting that eccentric. Like when you squat, you come down, that's your eccentric. You are not getting that eccentric movement. So you're actually just totally concentric. So you're getting rehab work done too. If you want to do light rehab work, it'll work fantastic. Let's say you want to add extra volume to leg day without doing more squats. Boy, this is a great way to do it.
So how much weight would you be pushing on the prowler?
Well, they have like it depends. The weights of the prowler, this one's fabricated, so it's not like the real prowler that you see like on Elite FTS.
Okay.
It's a fabricated, so it's a little bit heavier. But all I did was start with two plates, so okay. It's 90 pounds, and then you just keep adding. I mean, there's people that have done 400-pound pushes before.
Wow.
For me, like, you know, I did one plate, 1.5 plates, and to be honest, I didn't want to see the damn thing anymore. So what I'm going to end up doing is using progression with it. I use a slight progression with it. Like I'm going to do 2 days a week for the first couple weeks, 3 days a week for the next couple weeks. And I'm going to progress and see how it goes because I need my better conditioning. And this thing is just awesome.
Nice. You know what I used to do? We used to have a small sled over there at Novi.
Mm-hmm.
And I would put a single handle on it, like the handle that we would use over at like the cable machines. And then I would kind of squat down, keep my back perpendicular to the floor, and mm-hmm. I would row the sled toward me to create like a, you know, like a dumbbell row type movement, and then kind of jog back 3 steps, get back down into that squatted position with the back perpendicular to the floor and then row it again. And I'd do like my right side all the way to one end of the track. And then I'd turn it around and do my left side all the way back. Man, that was intense, I'll tell you.
It's incredible, too, because, again, you're not using you don't have an eccentric on that. So right. It's purely concentric. And so it helps with rehab. And you can gain muscle doing that without getting that, you know, damn the DOMS. So the delayed onset muscle soreness. So you can get like where, let's say you want to add an extra work, but you don't want to hurt your back, or you don't want to hurt, like you don't want to be sore. You're just doing some rehab work. You can do that, and you can actually gain muscle and hypertrophy off just that sled, but it's strictly concentric. So it doesn't have that huge impact on you as far as for the next couple of days whenever you're sore. So it's great for that.
You know, I would love to actually work that in, because posterior chain, glutes, and hamstrings are two things that I'm really trying to focus on right now. And I would love to bring those up. For some reason, my legs have grown, but I've got like the white guy's butt. You know, it's just non-existent. So, and especially then when I diet down, my glutes are, you know, by the time I get real lean, they look fine. And but then by the time that I'm really dieted down and I get like to the point where I'm getting striations and lines, at that stage, man, my ass just goes flat. It's definitely not the look you want, especially like from the side poses, you know?
Well, yeah, but I mean, like I said, I've seen your physique. You critique yourself like incredibly. So it's, you know, I think that like they have the prowler there. They also have the glute ham raise for you too.
I got to be careful with that one, with my lower back and the my lumbars and SI. They get real weird. So
you have to round the front. You have to round the front part of your body. So a lot of people tend to, you know, arch. How like when we, a lot of people arch. So you got to keep that round part.
It's hard for me to do that and still get enough weight into the hamstring and glute, because my hams and glutes are strong.
Okay.
So that's why I think that something like what you're talking about here with the prowler would be just a good overall body strengthening exercise.
I think so, and then you could push it heavy and slow, like push it as fast as you can, but it would be slow.
Okay.
And put as much weight on there as you can, and I think you would get that effect.
Nice. Well, after this, we'll have to chat, because I need to get up there with you one day.
Absolutely.
So I have three questions. I think I told you we had two, but I wanted to just cover a few questions today, because later I wanted to ask you about diuretics. This first question actually really applies to what we are talking about here, about central nervous system stimulation. And he says, I ask myself lately, what can I do to improve my central nervous system's ability to cope with stress during training? For example, on some days, I'm able to finish 12 reps even though I feel like I'm going to die. And then on other days, I'm only able to finish 7 or 8. What influences our body and our central nervous system to tolerate pain? Is there something I can do to teach myself to endure more pain? What do you think about this, Chuck? Because I feel like this is a great question for somebody who's into like just sheer strength. I imagine you had to learn how to overcome a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's something that's obviously trained. I mean, you have to kind of learn the difference also between pain and being hurt.
Sure.
So that's a big difference that you have to kind of like diagnose. But as far as for training pain, I mean, that's difficult. Powerlifters tend to, like I've said this before, powerlifters have a tendency to, like, let's say if you take somebody that's kind of new to the sport and they take 80% of their one rep max, they can do it 10, 15 times. You take a powerlifter that's been trained for a while that does 80% of their one rep max, they can do it 4 or 5 reps.
Okay.
The reason being is it's not conditioning. It's they've trained their central nervous system and their muscles to fire like all of them they at one time.
Yeah.
Like if you get somebody that's new to the sport, their muscles will only fire what they really need in order to do the reps.
Yes.
An elite athlete, or not, I'm not elite, but an athlete that's been doing it for a while trains all those muscle fibers and recruits all those muscle fibers to do each and every single rep. So that has a tendency to tire people out, or tire like people that have been lifting a while out. As far as for like training your muscles to like, I don't understand the question. Is it just trying to like for pain, like a pure pain issue, or is it more of an issue where it's just, I just want, like, wonder why I can't do more reps at a certain day?
I think what he's saying is that he's finding that he'll take, let's say, 225 on the squat, and on one day he's able to power through 12 reps, and on another day it's just that the pain builds up so much more great. Probably, and I think I've experienced that too at times where it's like, man, I just did 7 reps with a weight. I did 12 reps last week, but now I'm out of breath at 7 reps and I can hardly feel like I could push 8, you know?
There's different factors involving in that. There's sleep factors, there's diet factors, there's what happened to your day, how physical was your day. There's mental factors, you know, like, am I motivated to do 12 reps? I mean, there's a lot of different factors. I don't know if that's a central nervous system recruitment type thing. I think it's more of like, you know, like all those factors kind of come together. I've had days where I'm just not feeling it. The days you're just not feeling it, I mean, you push through the best that you can,
yep,
and you hope that the next workout's better. But you know, you push through with the best that you can. That's the only thing I can say. From my perspective, there's a lot of variables in that question. It's not like a CNS kind of question.
I agree. I think that what he might want to do is, you know, like you said, there's so many different issues. It could be, you know, ask yourself if your nutrition is up to snuff. You know, did you eat sweet potatoes before you trained the day that you got 12 reps and today you ate brown rice? Or maybe did you eat an hour before you trained on that workout and now you haven't eaten for 2.5 hours? Was it hotter outside and maybe you sweat a lot more, your hydration level is lower? I feel like all those things will play a role. As far as like a tolerance for pain and an ability to handle pain, I do feel that is something that I've built up over time. I feel like I've learned to withstand like more of that lactic acid muscle burn as I've trained, you know, and I've learned how to handle more of that and continue pushing through it. That in itself, that's just going to be a time factor. You know, the longer you train, the more years you've been at it. But those would be, I think, some good first places to look. And definitely, you know, like you were saying, Chuck, look at all the other factors, too. I could totally rate what you had said about, you know, somebody who's trained longer getting more out of a rep, because I've trained with people who are pretty much brand new to training. They've been training under 2 years and they're much smaller than me, yet they're pushing weight that I'm pushing and I'm getting a lot more out of it. I'm like, whoa, man, I just got, you know, I'm fatigued after that set. I'm tired and this guy's ready to keep going. And I don't think it's that he's stronger. And then I start looking at his form and I'm starting to watch him. And it's like, you know, he could have improved how he did his reps too, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely quality of rep. Like bodybuilding obviously is different than powerlifting, but bodybuilding, you know, a lot of it has to do with, like, we've talked about mind muscle connection before.
Yeah.
We've talked about like thinking about the muscle contracting and what do I want to feel and that type of a thing. Like if I'm doing like a bench press, what do I want to feel? Where do I want to feel it? If I'm doing a bicep curl, am I feeling it? Am I getting that cramp up in my bicep? You know, where am I feeling it? Am I feeling it in my forearm? Well, I don't want to do that. I want to try and feel it exactly where I want to.
Sure. Let's move on though, because we're running out of time here.
Sure.
So just a couple more really quick questions, and these are both drug related. This gentleman, this is from the Napsgear website. They have the Undercover Pro Q&A, and they were nice enough to lend us a couple of questions. So we pulled these from the site. They said that these would be good questions for us to go over with the listeners. And one gentleman asks, are there any Sustadon products that do not contain benzyl alcohol? Now, I think that's all he says, but I think what we're getting at here, my thought is this guy's experiencing a great deal of pain from his Sustadon shot, and he's equating that with benzyl alcohol. So, first of all, I mean, you want benzyl alcohol in your shot. Oil is going to be resistant to bacteria, say, compared to water. But at the same time, the benzyl alcohol is in the preparation in order to keep the product sterile and to keep it bacteria free. So you do want benzyl alcohol in there. I think his issue might be more related to the fast acting esters in the sustanon. Yep, exactly. Yep. So he's got some fast acting esters in that sustanon, and my thought is that's what's causing the pain. So that ester breaks down. It's a crude ester, you know, the propionate ester. And it breaks down quickly, and what you have left is basically like microscopic raw hormone in your muscle fiber, which is like tiny, tiny little crystals that are then rubbing back and forth, and they're causing irritation. So I found that after time of continuing using something like a propionate ester, sustanon, your body does get used to it the longer you've done it. But like we talked about before, man, that first time you take a sustanon shot, it hurts.
You feel like you get hit with a bat in your leg. Yeah.
Yeah, literally. And people don't really get how bad we mean, but it literally feels like that. His best bet might be to use a longer acting testosterone, you know, a testosterone enanthate or a testosterone cypionate. Or if he's doing this cycle with another product like Equipoise, you could mix part of your shot sustanon and part of it Equipoise. And then I think that would help too. You have any other thoughts on that one, Chuck?
No, I think the same thing. Like, you know, like years ago when I did sust, like I just remember the pain from it. I don't really like dealing with multiple esters. I kind of like dealing with like something that I can manipulate myself. Yeah. So like I tend to deal with just like, or like when I did, I tended to deal with just like test E or something like that.
Sure.
Because I didn't like that feeling, and you know, not being able to bend your leg or walk or climb upstairs. I mean, that sucks.
And it, you know, and it's counterproductive to training too.
Absolutely. So. It's hard to do legs when you're doing that.
Right. All right. So one more question. He says, this is my second cycle. I'm running 750 milligrams of test E. I'm 6 foot, 225 pounds, around 10%. I'm starting to bulk, but I wanted to add a cutting agent that isn't oral because I don't like stressing my liver. I know that Tren would be a good choice, but what else would work well for the last 6 to 8 weeks of this cycle? He says, I am thinking Masteron or D-Ball, though D-Ball is mainly used for bulking, but I've still had friends who've used it to cut. What would be your suggestions? And also, I'd like to keep pinning to a minimum. Out the gate here, I just want to point out, and I know you're going to be right on point with me on this, Chuck. I would think that this is a question of diet, you know, maybe a question of goals. He says that he's bulking here. This cycle is what he says.
750.
Yeah, 750. I'm looking for the time length here. So let's say he's doing 16 weeks, even, and then the last 6 to 8 weeks are going to be cutting. He's not really bulking for that long, you know. The test is going to take a month to really build up to super physiological levels. He's going to really get maybe 5 weeks effective bulking on gear, and then he's just going to start cutting. I feel like it's going to be counterproductive. He's going to be running in a circle.
I feel like that he just said that I'm bulking right now on 10%, but I want to add a cutting agent. I mean, you got to figure out your goal first
and go
with that. Like if you're going to bulk, you know, that's a lot of diet, a lot of like, you know, if you want to add D-ball in a bulk, hey, go for it, you know. Yep. But if you're trying to cut, you know, then, you know, you're going to probably use like, you know, if, you know, you're going to use your trend, you're going to watch your diet, you're going to watch like, you know, that type of stuff. I think dieting is far more important than what, you know, kind of anabolic that you use.
Sure.
But you got to figure out your goal. I mean, the goal is the main thing. So if you want to add weight, okay, add weight through food. If you're going to lose weight, you know, and if you're going to try and cut, I just adding different things to me is not the key. Figure out your goal, adjust your diet accordingly, and then add something.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how I feel.
I totally agree with you, man. Because the diet is what's going to get you leaner. You know, adding a cutting drug is not going to, quote, get you cut. You know, the cutting drugs are more or less steroids that don't add a lot of additional water weight. And so you're not going to be bulky and fluidy, you know, while you're on those things. And so if you are cut down, you'll be able to see more vascularity and more definition to the muscle. But the drug is not going to get you cut. My thought is I would spend this cycle, quote unquote, bulking, you know, and if you find that you're getting overweight and fat, then you got to adjust the diet in order to fix that. And you could be on a test. And, you know, he said he's considering some other, you know, you could be on what you would consider a bulking diet and still look pretty damn sharp.
Well, look at you, Scott. I mean, like, you know, you've been trying to put on some size and you're still lean as hell, vascular. You've got your abs. I mean, you're still very lean doing that. So
yeah, it's all in nutrition, you know?
Yep.
Even now I'm introducing insulin into the plan and, taking, Humalog pre-workout. And, you know, between that and even the MK677, that also creates a lot of fluid retention. You know, I'm still pretty vascular and hard looking. So, you know, those things are the key. And my suggestion is give yourself more than a few weeks to try to add mass.
And then And if you want to be fat and doughy, follow my diet plan.
All right, man. So, you know, next here, I wanted to move on, and this is something I've been wanting to ask you about for a while. Okay. You know, we've got a rare opportunity here because Chuck is a registered nurse that specializes in working with cardiac patients and people who are dealing with any concerns of the heart. There's always going to be a lot of manipulation and regulation of fluid retention. This all plays a critical role, correct?
Absolutely. So life goes forward. If your heart's got to pump forward, if your heart can't pump forward and it starts to back up, well, life can't work that way. So what we do in order to help patients pump blood forward is we can do a couple things. If the heart's weak, we can give things called inotropes or, you know, medications that cause the heart to pump harder, slight delay, pump harder. Or we can also, like, give medications to diurese the patient, because if you have less blood to pump forward, the heart doesn't have to work quite so hard, particularly if they're overloaded. So that's one of the reasons that we use diuretics. A lot of heart failure patients, we use diuretics.
So for your cases, you guys are using some pretty heavy-duty stuff. We're talking like the Lasix and the Bumix, right?
We're using Lasix, Bumix, and sometimes mannitol. Mannitol will remove all the water from your body completely. Wow. Mannitol is only to be used in like a hospital setting. Where you can regulate it, because mannitol can kill you quickly.
Can I get a shot of that before my next show?
No. Mannitol they use for people with like severe head injuries or people that have like swelling of the brain, hydrocephalus. They'll use mannitol. But it just gets rid of every little bit of water out of your body. I mean, it goes from top to bottom.
And now these are considered like loop diuretics, correct? The things
Lasix and Bumix are loop diuretics.
Yeah, yes. that's what I was getting at. So, you know, I've never heard of Bumix being used in bodybuilding, but I know that Lasix was very popular, you know, back in the 90s. And a lot of people say that that's maybe one of the reasons that the guys looked as sharp as they did. But Lasix can also be an extremely dangerous drug. Can you give us like just the simple man's breakdown on why that is?
Why is it so dangerous?
Yes.
A couple reasons. You can do a lot of different things with it. A big thing is, you know, dehydration. Dehydration in itself can lead to death. You can get hyponatremic. Hyponatremic means you can have a low sodium content in your blood, because essentially you're losing everything. You're losing sodium, you're losing potassium, you're losing a lot of different things. You can get I've talked about it before, when your potassium gets low, you can go through heart arrhythmias and you can go through death. I mean, if your potassium directly helps control your heart. In your body, you have a sodium potassium pump. And certain cells have sodium potassium pump. They pump certain things in, certain things out, that type of a thing. And that has to be regulated. If you don't have those, you can die. There's just so many different things. But the big thing for me is potassium. Potassium and your electrolytes. Magnesium goes too low, you can go into something called torsades. Torsades is a heart rhythm where it's just a very particular type of heart rhythm that the cure for it is a bunch of magnesium.
Okay.
So a lot of it has to do with heart arrhythmias and a lot of it has to do with like the sodium potassium, ATPase pump.
Okay. So nowadays in bodybuilding, there are a couple of diuretics that are, you know, more popular, and they're from different classes. So those are the two things I would be most interested in hearing about. Those two diuretics would be the Maxide or Diazide, as well as Aldactone. So could you tell us about Diazide and how this works?
Yeah, a couple different things. I just want to run a very quick kind of brief thing on it.
Sure.
Four classes of diuretics. There's loop, and then there's osmotic. Those are the ones that we're probably not going to use. Then there's thiazides, and everybody's heard of hydrochlorothiazides.
Sure.
And potassium-sparing drugs. There's a couple different types of potassium-sparing drugs. Basically, what diuretics do, in a nutshell, is they block sodium and chloride reabsorption into the blood. So what it does is it stays in the kidney. Sodium and chloride stay in the kidney, and water follows those two electrolytes. So if sodium and chloride are still in the kidney, water will follow it, and so it excretes it out along with it.
Okay.
So that's the general kind of way a diuretic works. It stops the reabsorption in the blood from the sodium and chloride, and then water follows, so it stays in the kidney, gets out. So that's your basic diuretic, and that's kind of what a loop does.
Okay.
Regular thiazides, like hydrochlorothiazides and that type of a thing.
Yes.
Hydrochlorothiazides are basically – they add them to like the diazide has a hydrochlorothiazide in it. Aldactone usually has a hydrochlorothiazide in it too. And what these are is they're a little bit less extreme than a Bumex or a Lasix.
Okay.
So you're going to get excretion, or you're going to maintain like the sodium and the chloride in the kidney, and you're going to pee out, but not quite as much. Like usually they work like 2 hours. If it's an oral, usually within 2 hours, and the peak time is like 4 to 6 hours.
Okay.
Okay. Those are your thiazides. Then the ones that we speak of a lot are the potassium-sparing thiazides. You know how we talk about, like I said, potassium is very important for your heart. So if you're taking a thiazide, or if you're taking Bumex or Lasix, there's a really good chance that you could be low on potassium. So usually, like, I take a thiazide for my blood pressure. So what do I do is I supplement a potassium supplement, just usually like 99 milligrams once or twice a day. Of, you know, like just from like, you know, Whole Foods or something like that.
Okay.
So you have potassium sparing diuretics, and basically you're going to get not quite as much urine coming out, but you're going to get a decrease in the potassium secretion. Usually we use these in conjunction with thiazides.
Okay.
Okay. So we'll use the potassium sparing along with thiazides. Like spironolactone, it blocks aldosterone. So these potassium-sparing drugs, or a lot of these drugs, will block the mineral corticoid aldosterone. Whenever you see people taking prednisone, like, have you ever had anybody that you know that's taken prednisone, or have you yourself ever taken it?
Both cases, okay. Yes.
And what happens? What happens to your body?
Oh, you swell up.
Right.
Terribly.
And you get hungry, right?
True.
And that has a lot to do with sugar release. So it releases sugar from your liver. So these aldosterone, these mineral corticoids, what can happen is you get that huge bloat and you get hungry. So what we use is this drug to block that. So basically the aldosterone causes you to promote sodium retention. So the spironolactone causes the exact opposite. So it causes like an excretion of sodium, reduced fluid, but it maintains your potassium. If your potassium gets too high, though, that can be a problem too. So what we do is a lot of times we use like the thiazides along with it. So diazide is a combination of like a hydrochlorothiazide, which is a normal diuretic. It's just an essential, diuretic that we use. It's moderate. And then it's another, they use like a potassium sparing diuretic along with that.
So what you're telling me is
two of them.
It's commonly believed that diazide is a potassium sparing diuretic, but what you're telling me is it's partially a potassium sparing diuretic and the other side is not.
Yes, absolutely.
Interesting. So that's definitely absolutely good information to have, because I think a lot of people are under the impression that there is no potassium loss while taking diazide.
No, they're actually like in, you know, the aldactoside, it's a combination of spironolactone and like hydrochlorothiazide too. So diazide is a combination of trimetazidine and hydrochlorothiazide, where aldactazone is a combination of spironolactone and hydrochlorothiazide.
Okay.
So we're using both of them. So, you know, if you look at it, you still are getting the water release. They tend to, like Lasix, when we use Lasix on like somebody at work, we tend to use Lasix. We tend to give them like an IV of it. And within like minutes, I mean 2 minutes, they're just excreting water. So you have to make sure, like when you give them stuff, a Lasix, you give them potassium along with it, or you make sure that their potassium is at an optimal level.
And this is something that you can monitor at the hospital.
At the hospital.
Guys are not able to monitor this backstage at a contest.
Absolutely. I'm not a big fan of I'm really not a big fan of diuretics in general. I like simpler diuretics like dandelion root or something like that. But I mean, I know people do this, so this is something I like to talk about.
Sure.
Diazide and like aldactone are basically like they're using a hydrochlorothiazide there. So they are potassium sparing because, you know, they have the trimetazidine or, you know, they have the spironolactone in there, but there's still hydrochlorothiazide involved in that. So you are getting some excretion. But the thing is like diuretics can work pretty well together. Like a lot of times you just don't give somebody like a Lasix pill.
Sure.
You give them, you know, they'll be on some other type of diuretic, probably a potassium sparing diuretic. So, I mean, that's the best that I can do on that. I think that when you watch your potassium, when you're taking some sort of a diuretic, a lot of times you want to monitor for certain things. Thirst is one thing. Thirst is one of those things that when you're pretty dehydrated, you get thirsty.
Sure.
So we get dehydrated before we're thirsty.
Right.
So when you start getting very thirsty, that's one of the things where, you know, you want to make sure you're consuming a lot of water. Second thing is like, you know, you want to make sure that your heart is working fine. If you feel like your heart is palpating, getting palpitations, that type of a thing. Yeah, obviously that's something that is a sign that you're, you know, too dehydrated. The other thing is kind of like not delirium, but confusion. When your sodium gets too low, you can get very confused. That's something to kind of watch out for. The other thing to watch out for is cramping. Cramping, when you cramp, usually that's a sign of an electrolyte imbalance, potassium or magnesium. And that's another sign that you have to watch out for. So
I've experienced all these things competing.
I know,
especially in my earlier days, I was more aggressive with diuretics when I first started. Since then, I've learned that diuretics can be used minimally. You know, the key is to get as lean as you can. And if you are in shape, if you have no body fat on you, you're not going to hold water. You know, the water draws into the fat. So if you get rid of the fat, then the water has nowhere to go. You'll drink water. If you're shredded and you're shredded 2 weeks out from a show, you'll drink water. And 5 minutes later, you will have to pee because it's just not going to hold in your body.
Yeah, because the other thing, too, is like a lot of times when we're a lot of times when we're dehydrated for a show, we're also carb depleted like crazy.
Sure.
So, you know, carbohydrates hold water. So if we don't have the carbs in us, and plus we don't have a lot of intravascular fluid in us, you know, you're basically, you know, you're not going to hold any water, like you said. The other thing is too, is, and we talk about it like at work too, is you can be like extravascularly overloaded and intravascularly depleted.
Okay.
Meaning your body, like a lot of times, like you see people with heart failure, like you'll see swollen legs or you'll see like, you know, their hands will be swollen or their feet will be swollen, but they don't have a lot of fluid in their system. So a lot of times that can be a couple different things. One could even be like simple malnutrition. If you're malnourished, you're not able to maintain – if you're not taking enough protein, you're not able to maintain osmotic pressure in your – in your the walls of your arteries in order in your vessels in order to like maintain fluid intravascularly. So that's something else. You see a lot of people like that, but there's many, many reasons. The thing that I can just stress enough with diuretics, and I think we say it every week, take the minimal amount in order to get the maximum effect. And it's a safer way of doing it. And then, you know, also just monitor certain things. Like, do you remember Mohamed Benaziza?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And you remember Andreas Munzer, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Those are two of the most shredded bodybuilders ever, but they're dead. Dead because of diuretic usage.
Munzer's one of my favorite bodybuilders because of how shredded he was able to get.
He was ridiculous, and he was grainy, and to the point where, you know, him and Momo Benaziza during the time of Dorian Yates, they were looking at those guys as people that could possibly replace Yates.
Yeah, yeah.
But they died from a diuretic problem, so they took too many diuretics, and I believe they died from failure, their heart failure. And sodium potassium pump was not working, I'm sure. So
the key is, you know, like I was saying a minute ago, you want to get in the best shape that you can. And if you get totally shredded, you will not need diuretics. You know, I've had people that have been so lean that they've been able to go into a show still drinking water, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's rare that people can do that. And it's difficult, you know, to put that work in. But if you do your homework and you do all that stuff early enough, then you'll be in a position where, you know, you won't have to go that route. And then, you know, there's so many options and so many things we can do before we add the diuretic. You know, there's the idea of water loading where we increase water intake, you know, the week before the show, and then we slowly taper it out. You know, if you do that, that in itself is going to create a big effect. Or a lot of times I'll use sodium loading where I get somebody used to eating a lot of salt and their body finds homeostasis. And then when we get to the show, if needed, we can pull that salt out and create a diuretic like effect. And then we know what we've pulled out. We can completely control that. If we need to, we can push the salt back in. I think that more times than not, Chuck, people end up messing their physiques up because of diuretics. Even, you know, they're so strong, and even a tiny bit can just flatten somebody out and make it very difficult to come in full.
You know, we're talking like at contest show, like we used to have like, I mean, I didn't do it, but we used to have people that wouldn't brush their teeth a couple days from the contest because they didn't want to have sodium introduced in their body. So you're talking subtle variances that are like so minuscule that cause such an effect, or that you think cause such an effect.
Right.
Imagine like the difference between toothpaste and a fucking diuretic.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, but that's the extreme that people take it. And I think I really do like your philosophy on dieting and your philosophy on contest ready, because like your philosophy is get your body homeostatic, get your body used to something, and then change.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I really, really think that's probably the purest philosophy on body composition that you could possibly have. I think that's awesome.
Well, thanks a lot, Chuck, for all this advice. I mean, this stuff I think could be super helpful to a lot of people. Diuretics are something that are not talked about a lot. You know, people say diuretics are the most dangerous thing in bodybuilding, and then that's all that they say, you know? So
yeah. I think that and insulin are things that really need to have, like, you need to do your homework on that stuff. And I'm not a big fan of diuretics at all, to be honest. I just want to throw that out there. Not at all. I think that somebody like you that can help manipulate water a better way through food, through other things, I think that's a better way than diuretic manipulation. Because if you get it off just a little bit, you can die.
Yeah. And, you know, this year, I can tell you that I have helped a lot more people that have not used any diuretic versus the people that have. And the people that have used diuretics have kept it very minimal. Like I'm talking, I will suggest somebody takes like, we'll say a quarter of a tab of diazide, you know, like,
yeah.
And that's it. And that's just to push what we're already doing just a little bit further. You know, it's been very small. I mean, the amount of times out of the number of people I've helped this year alone, the amount of times we've used a diuretic has been so small. It's really, like I said, it's different than when I started, because this is stuff I didn't know. So when I first started, I was using a lot of diuretics. I felt like that's what you had to do at each show. And Chuck, I'm talking like a half a diazide every 3 hours, you know, starting at 6 p.m. the day before the show. You know, by the end of the day, you've taken it over 2 diazide tabs, and then you wake up and take another half of one in the morning. So there's no wonder that I was backstage pumping up and seeing like flickering lights to the sides of my vision and, you know, feeling dizzy and feeling cramps all over. And
yeah, everything I talked about, everything I said.
Every single one of those things. And I'll tell you what, too, man, your recovery post-contest is so much better, and your rebound, it's so much better, man, because once you throw everything off like that, it's going to be a bitch post-contest trying to get your water and your fluid balance back out. It can take a month.
Oh, yeah, it could take several months, too. Like I said, I really think that my training philosophy and your philosophy on dieting meshes very, very well.
I agree.
Because we both think of the same things, and we both have the same philosophy. Accordingly, we it kind of meshes together extremely well.
I agree, man.
Yeah, it's one of the, like, I love purists in any sort of form. Like, I love, like, pure sprinters or people that have, like, you know, if you see people that are, like, the outdoorsmen and they hunt and they fish and they do all that stuff and they build a log cabin in the woods. I love purists, but the fact that your philosophy is like that, I love.
All right, man. Well, thank you, Chuck, for being with me tonight. I got to take off. I'm getting ready to head to the gym. I got to be there in a half hour, so I'm about to finish my last meal here and hop in the car and get going. So,
well, Scott, it's good. Always, it's great talking to you. And everybody, thanks for listening. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
For Advices Radio and Chuck Zarowski, this is Scott McNally. Keep grinding. Time to ramble on.